This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today is Election Day. Perhaps you've heard, though only a tiny fragment of registered voters will exercise what many consider to be the sacred right to vote. Low voter turnout is the rule in most off-year elections, as well as elections that focus primarily on local candidates and issues. In Charlotte, the choice for mayor, members of city council and school board, and the major decision of whether to spend $922 million, nearly $1 billion, on school bonds will all fall to about 17% of the voting age population. 17%. Wow. 66% voted here in the last presidential election, yet it could be safely argued that the candidates we elect today will have far more impact on our lives than whether Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump ended up in the White House. So this hour, we examine why local and off-year elections fail to capture voters' interests and what, if anything, can be done to boost participation. Dolores Johnson Hurt is president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg League of Women Voters, and she is back with us. Good to see you again.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Your listeners might be interested in knowing that years ago, the two of us were reporters at a radio station, NBC-affiliated, in South Carolina. So it's very serendipitous that we're with each other again.
And here we are. She's in our Spirit Square studio. With us by phone is Phil Kiesling, director of the Center for Public Service at the Mark O. Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University School of Government in Portland, Oregon, where it's very early in the morning. Thank you for getting up. Thank you for being here.
Delighted to be here.
And equally early in the morning, I think, is the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. That is where Aaron Weinschenk is joining us. He's an assistant professor of political science there. He joins us via Skype. Thank you for being here, too, Aaron.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So before we talk about why voter turnout may be low for off-year and local elections, let me ask this. Has it always been this way, or is this a modern development in America? I'm not sure who to ask that question of. I'll start with you, Dolores, locally. Has it always been that way here?
Well, you know what, Mike? I'm going to defer to the experts on that.
All right. Phil Kiesling, Aaron Weinschenk, which one of you wants to take that? Phil,
I'll dive in. I think if you go back to the 1980s, you'll actually see a lot of turnout in major cities that was probably 3-5 times higher. The Los Angeles race, Sam Yorty, Tom Bradley era. There's definitely been a decline over the decades as fewer and fewer people have participated in these local elections.
And
Aaron,
I think you've
looked at this as well.
Aaron, go ahead.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And if you look especially at the big city mayoral elections, New York, Los Angeles, if you go back a couple decades, you'll see much higher turnout. There's been a pretty steady decline in a lot of cities over the past, 20, 25 years or so.
And do we have any idea why? What's driving it?
Well, I can speak to that.
Okay.
If you don't mind. There seems to be a disconnect between voters or folks in general knowing that it is not the presidential election but the local elections that really impact everyday life, from taxes to what schools your kid goes to, what the quality of the teachers are, your water bill, how your city physically looks. Everything is determined by, in a city, the mayor and city council.
Yeah. And last week, one of our producers was asked this question by someone. Why is everyone so focused on the mayor's race? Because after all, in Charlotte, it's a weak mayor system. City council votes. Mayors only vote in the case of a tie. They really don't have any other powers other than the bully pulpit or be the moral leader or try to steer things in a certain way. So why does who becomes mayor matter? And in fact, does it matter?
Well, the mayor is the face of the city. The mayor has a bully pulpit and can be effective in swaying voters to vote in certain ways. Mm-hmm. And I think there's an influx of money these days in this race in particular, in the mayor's race, because there's more at stake, I think. The last national election with the successful campaign of Donald Trump has encourage more people to participate in the election. Charlotte is a growing city, and so accordingly, there's more importance placed on the city elections, although we're only expecting 70% of the voters, the registered voters, to vote.
How much? 17%?
17%.
Yeah, that's what I heard yesterday as well, and we'll see tomorrow whether that turned out to be true. But the mayor in Charlotte gets asked – the candidates for mayor have been asked a lot of questions over the race that really have nothing to do with the city. It's the county that does a lot of these things, and that seems to be a major stumbling block for a lot of people. They don't know whether it's the county or the city that's responsible for this, that, or the other thing. Is that part of the problem? It's so confusing that why bother?
I really think that is part of the problem. First of all, we do not have mandatory civics classes taught in the schools. And I think at least that should be done. The league here offers a 5-day course in civics where we talk about city, county, the judiciary, and those kinds of things for adults here in Charlotte. I think that we ought to seriously look at, in CMS, the possibility of having a short course such as that taught to juniors and seniors. We have to let our young people know how seriously voting is, or how serious voting is. And one of the steps is to get our children involved.
Ann Doss Helms, who is the education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, has said several times on this program, and I think in print, that it is arguably true that the school board elections are probably more important than the mayoral elections, particularly if you have kids, because those are the people that will be making major decisions about the future of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. And maybe the same is true for members of council, and there will be considerable turnover on both the school board and council because of incumbents deciding not to run, and because the two mayoral candidates come from the ranks of city council, and they will not be on the council if they lose this election, and somebody will replace both of them in those seats. So why isn't that enough to get people to turn out?
It's a lack of knowledge. Some people feel their votes do not count. You have a lack of electronic media attention to those races. For example, traditionally, the league here in Charlotte has had debates on public TV for all of the local elections. Guess what? This past year, we could only do the mayoral debate. Our debates for in the primary, you know, and then we had one for the general election. To me, that's a shame. And the county commission sponsored all of those debates up until this year.
Talk to me about votes not mattering. Aaron, the presidential election was decided by a fairly slim margin this time, and it's not unusual in recent years for the presidential race to be decided that way, or for it to come down to just a couple of votes in the Electoral College, which is a reflection of the popular vote. Do votes matter? Clearly, to me, they do, but why don't people believe that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that could be driven by, you know, people's perceptions during presidential elections and the competitiveness of particular states relative to others. You know, if you live in a battleground state like my state or your state, you know, you probably get a lot of attention from the campaigns. Maybe the margin's pretty close. If you live in California or New York, you're probably going to think that the outcome in your particular state is a foregone conclusion. So I think that could maybe, you know, that kind of approach could kind of trickle down, and people in certain places might think, well, you know, there's a big majority of the place I live, and I'm in the minority, so my vote really doesn't matter. It's gonna happen the way it does anyways.
It's a self-fulfulling prophecy, though, isn't it?
If you don't participate, you're
going to lose.
Yeah, absolutely. Or if you don't participate and you think there are serious issues, you know, you have provided no input into the selection of people who could potentially address those issues.
So, Phil Kiesling, Go ahead, Phil.
So, I was going to add two other components. I mean, one of the things that our research found is there was a huge generational divide here in terms of voting habits and patterns. That you look at, 18 to 34-year-olds in Charlotte in the last mayoral election, I think the turnout there was a whopping 9%. 36-37% of the population that could have voted, only about 8% of the share of votes actually cast, whereas 65-plus, their share was less, a lot less, maybe 13-14%, and they account for 30% or more. So I think you have that as a factor in the landscape as well, that these habits of voting much skewed to older voters. Odds of them voting 10, 12, 15 times more than 18 to 34-year-olds. And that, I think, then reflects in the kinds of issues that candidates talk about and where they pitch those issues to much more to the people that are going to vote rather than
I was going to talk about this later, but let's bring this up now because you have done this survey, which we'll talk about. And Charlotte, as you've said, is an example of where voters, at least in the 2015 mayoral election here, were 15.4 years older than voting age residents on average. So that means that given that in 2015 in Charlotte, 6.1% of registered voters over the age of 65 voted as to compared to 4.3% of those 18 to 34, that gave voters 65 or older 16 times greater electoral clout than younger voters. Younger voters are ceding the power to their elders.
That's right. And they're doing it in cities across the country. I mean, Charlotte was a little lower than average in our sample at about 9% in the determinative election, really decided the race. Typically, we got more like 20%, but that's not a huge difference. 4 out of 5 on average, sitting it out across the country. And the odds that, you know, if you walk into a room and you've got in Charlotte, if you had 15 people, 18 to 34. And you had one person 65 and older. If you're a politician who's looking for votes wherever they can find them and want to maximize their time, they're going to spend the time with the one person over 65 rather than the 15 younger ones, because literally the odds are higher that that person will end up becoming a voter. So I think that's been a change. I think many people think the presidential race is kind of it. It's the one election in American politics that isn't a spectator sport today. Every other election, the midterms, it's only 64% sat out eligible voters back in 2014. Party primary elections, where we really decide who's going to represent us in Congress and state legislature for about 90% of the races, we have 85% of the eligible sit out. In fact, those are even worse on average than mayor elections. So it's an endemic problem across the landscape. You know, even when you hold elections in periods that are more common to people, and as I think we've talked about, odd-numbered geared elections where mayor races go often or where there's only just a few things on the ballot.
Dolores?
Isn't there the aspect also that the local parties and incumbents really don't want a large turnout in the primaries because they want to get their people out? And if you have a larger voting pool, you really don't have as much control. Could that not be a factor as well?
Yeah, I'll try, Aaron.
I'll tell you what, we have to. Our guests in remote locations have no idea that we're coming up to a break. So we're coming up to a break, Aaron. I'll let you answer that question in just a moment. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and WTVI PBS Charlotte's Carolina Impact, featuring a program that teaches teens about careers in the legal field, plus a charity that refurbishes skateboards and helps kids in need. Tonight at 8 on PBS Charlotte and Gardner Webb University, a Christian liberal arts experience with more than 80 undergraduate and graduate major fields of study. Ignite your future at gardner-webb.edu. Well, the most expensive mayoral race in Charlotte history took us to today, Election Day, in a dead heat. And the winner will be working with a council that will have at least 5 new members. So tomorrow on this program, we examine the results. What did you decide about those races, the school board race, and about the school bond issue? And then something surprising, the rising confidence people have now in the 4th estate. How about that? We'll do that tomorrow at 9.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the Donna Brazile bombshells. Did the DNC rig the Democratic primary for Hillary Clinton? We'll dive in. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point right after Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about elections and why turnout is so low. And today is election day in Charlotte for mayor and city council and school board and school bonds. And the turnout is expected to be about 17%, which is embarrassingly miserable, to be honest about it. Dolores Johnson Hurt is with us. She's the president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg League of Women Voters. Phil Kiesling joins us from Portland, Oregon, where he's director of the Center for Public Service at the Mark Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University. And Aaron Weinschenk is associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Dolores posed a question before the break, Aaron, that you were going to take a crack at, and that is is part of the problem with low voter turnout in these elections, the fact that incumbents really don't want a big turnout because that might jeopardize their incumbency. And I'll expand it even more. What we have done with gerrymandering and drawing voting districts and things like that to keep the party in power has that discouraged voting, particularly in areas where you know a Democrat or a Republican is going to win.
So I'll just answer kind of the low turnout incumbent benefit stuff first. So there is pretty good evidence that lower turnout is beneficial to the incumbents who serve. And it's not that hard to figure out why. Like, if there's a smaller pool of voters, it's probably going to be the people who are most committed, who are most informed about local politics. And they probably have some connection to the incumbent, whether it's the mayor or the person who's in their district. As you increase turnout, the chances go up that you've got more unreliable voters, probably people who aren't paying as much attention, maybe don't have as much of a connection to the incumbent who's serving. So, yeah, there's definitely evidence that that lower turnout is a useful thing for incumbents.
Hmm. And does that then, is that somehow telegraphed, or do we intuit that and decide, well, it doesn't matter, so I'm not going to go and vote? Why waste my time?
Go for it.
Yeah, I think that is part of the message as well. I mean, I was a former elected official in the state of Oregon and got to know that world a little bit. One of the things candidates hate doing, for the most part, is raising oodles of money, and you have to do that if it's a close race. And if you're not even opposed, that often can be what you want as well. But I also think that it's, there's other structural issues that are going on in these elections too, and I just want to mention a reform that Oregon has done and started to do 30 years ago, and it's literally to change the dynamic of asking people to go to their ballot, go to a polling place, or arrange ahead of time for an absentee ballot, and instead just simply mail them their ballot ahead of the election. We have a local election out here that's pretty obscure. It's one issue on a school bond measure, but it's a big deal for the school. The ballot shows up in the mail, and it's a prompt to remind people, oh, there's an election going on. And when the media covers these things much less than they used to, something like that, I think, can really help people kind of start tuning in. We're busier than ever. We're working longer hours. People are raising kids in many cases. It's another reason for the generational divide, I think. So I think there's some structural issues we can look at to try to just make the voting process go a lot easier, and in local elections in particular.
In most places, and I would say almost 100% of the places in America, there's nothing equivalent to MSNBC, CNN, or Fox News that covers politics on a local or state level the way those networks cover it on a national level, whether you take the left perspective or the right perspective or a centrist perspective. So when you have what many people consider to be ho-hum races, like school board and city council, and even the mayor of Charlotte in a weak mayor system, Dolores, how do you get people interested in – and you have to – as a voter in this city, at least, you have to do a lot of work to find out who's on the ballot and what they stand for. And it's not being spoon-fed to you.
That is the problem, although you can go online nowadays and register to vote and find out everything about the candidates, still you have to make the time to do that. And folks do lead very busy lives. There's another aspect that I'd like to touch on also, and that is in America, there's a long tradition of voter suppression. And among black voters, of course, blacks have been murdered trying to get the right to vote. So there, in the black community, there's not that tradition of widespread voting, of voting that has been passed down from generation to generation.
But once the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1968, why didn't that open the floodgates to people who had been so long denied and oppressed and having to pay poll taxes and take ridiculous tests in order to be able to vote that white people certainly couldn't have passed? Suddenly that all went away and the doors open. Why didn't that just caused the floodgates to open?
The same reason why you have low white turnout in local elections. Okay. Very same reasons. Ho-hum elections. You don't really know who's running for office because you don't get a chance oftentimes to see the candidates up close, face-to-face, where you can assess them within a few minutes' time. Those are some of the reasons right there. You don't have money from the national parties being funneled to the local elections oftentimes, so much.
So nationally, we have this fragmented media landscape where people tend to gravitate toward the points of view that already enforce what they believe. Is anybody doing this particularly well, Phil, in any part of the country where local media really helps explain the candidates and the issues in local elections, where people can easily find this information?
Well, that's a great question. Our research didn't get into kind of the role that the media plays. I was a former journalist in my own community. I don't think it's very distinguished because I think the general landscape is that, the number of reporters has just gone down. And so you obviously get stories, especially right before an election comes up. But I think the coverage could be a lot better. Now, you do have some local, often alternative press and papers that are doing a better coverage, but I think for the most part the picture painted is my experience is pretty accurate. It gets lost in the media maw. We're almost deluged with more information than ever before, but so much of the focus, particularly in the era of Trump, is on what's going on nationally rather than what's going on in our own communities.
When former Charlotte Mayor Pat McCrory last ran for that office prior to becoming governor, voter turnout here was 24%. Mayoral elections here have seen turnout as low as 15% since that time. And as we've said, today is predicted to be about 17%. But overall, voter turnout in off-year elections everywhere has been on the decline. And Aaron, you say it could go even lower. That's shocking. Why do you say that?
Well, I say that mostly based on the fact that there are some cities where it's even lower than 20%. I mean, there are stories all across the country where there are huge issues at stake. There's a great story from a little town in Oklahoma. There's about 1,000 people. There was $1 million school bond up, and only 5 people out of about 1,000 registered voters turned up to vote on that issue. So, 5 divided by 1,000 is a pretty small proportion of people voting. So the evidence is clear that it could happen and is happening in a lot of places across the country.
And last week, Portland State released a study on voter turnout revealing what your institution, Phil Kiesling, described as a shockingly low voter turnout for mayoral elections in America's 30 largest cities, including Charlotte. Voter turnout in places like New York City, Baltimore, and Miami was less than 15%, and in Las Vegas and places like Dallas-Fort Worth, it was in the single digits. Where was turnout respectable?
Well, the highest was it's a good question. The land of the blind, the one-eyed royalty. The highest turnout actually was in our own community in Portland, Oregon, where it was about 60%. Now, one thing there, we was about the only major city where our mayoral election coincided with the presidential race. That's very rare. The vast majority of these are held in odd-numbered years, not even. Louisville got up to 45%. Seattle was 44. Chicago, which did have a very contested race, about 33%. But the median, half above, half below, ended up at about the 20% mark across the country.
And your study found some cities had something I've never heard of before, voting deserts. We've heard of food deserts. These are voting deserts. 10.5% of voting age citizens in Charlotte, you say, live in a voting desert. So what is that?
Yeah, a voting desert is where you look at the citywide average, and Charlotte, I think, was 16% in the 2015 race, and we said, where is turnout actually just half or less of that? Where is it 7.5% or less? It's whatever the level is, abysmal or not, if you had less than half that turnout, we considered it a voting desert. And if you look at a map of Charlotte on our website, which is just whovotesformayor.org, you'll see where these deserts are. And you'll also see what we call desert oasis, the south side of Charlotte, where the turnout was quite a bit higher than the citywide average. So we think it's important to map both the geography as well as the generational impacts of voter turnout. Because obviously, in every election, somebody wins, whether the turnout's 50% or 2%. Mm-hmm. Aaron's story is has an analog in Oregon, where years ago, before we actually went to voting at home and mailing people ballots, we had a school bond passed with two votes. And when it passed 2-0, and the reporter asked to see the names of the voters who had cast ballots, it was public information everywhere, they hesitated because they said, oh my gosh, we'll betray the secret ballot because it passed. Now they had to release the names, but the Secretary of State back then, a Republican, I'm a Democrat, but Norma Paulus said, this is crazy. There's got to be a better way. So it can get lower, especially if people sense that there's no real contest going on. And even when there's no competitive race, I think it's really important for people to show up because if people feel that they're not representing as many people as possible in the community, I think it just can lead sometimes to a sense of isolation and among elected officials as well. So our study just kind of looks at this geography, and I think it's people can go to in Charlotte and see how their own neighborhood did.
This is a fascinating map, by the way. It's interactive, and you can change it as you're on the website. I'm going to give the website out again for people who want to play with it. It's called whovotesformayor.org. Whovotesformayor.org. I was on it and playing around with it yesterday, and what you also find in that is that age, as you say, is the biggest factor in determining who votes. Young people may be at the forefront of changing society, but it is old people who decide on policy. And policy and societal changes are often in conflict. The fact that they're in conflict, it would seem to me, might be discouraging to people. That's why they don't vote, because they see nothing happening that's interesting to them. They think the world ought to be one way, but it's never going to change. Why haven't they made the connection that perhaps it's never going to change because they're never going to vote?
Well, I think it's a matter of education, starting, as I mentioned before, in our schools with teaching civics and the importance of...
I've said before on this program that we don't teach civics
correct.
In public schools, and I have been challenged by teachers who teach civics who say I am wrong about that.
Well, it's not emphasized then. It's not mandatory, and I feel that it should be mandatory.
Is that true across the country, gentlemen? Are we falling down on the job of teaching people how this government works and why participation in it is important and how we can participate and how we make changes? Because people have fought and died for this, right? And now we just kind of turn our backs on it. Aaron, I'll let you take that one.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is mandatory in some places. I usually ask that question when I start my American government class every semester. I'll say, how many of you took a mandatory civics class? I would say, 60% have taken at least one civics class. The rest of people didn't have mandatory requirements in their high schools. But even if they did have a civics class, it was probably late in their high school career, and they probably only took one class on it. And I don't think that one intervention like that is probably enough to turn people into the ideal democratic citizens that we want them to be. We probably want to start earlier. We probably want to reinforce it over time. You know, we teach things like math and English every single year, but we don't teach civics every single year. So I think there could really be some changes in kind of how we administer civics education.
We had an email from Bill in Davidson who says there are civics classes in North Carolina. He said it doesn't mean that they are well taught or enticing, but they do exist. And his theory is that they are taught in 10th grade, which is too far away from when people are voting age, and then they're not reinforced later. So perhaps I think you mentioned that they maybe ought to be taught in the last year of high school.
Yes, junior and senior years. And a civics class doesn't have to be a semester-long or quarter-long course. As I said before, you can do a five-day course on local politics. Many people do not know what the city government does, what the county commission does, what the judiciary does, what the school board of education does. And I think just a short mandatory course in CMS schools, for example, might add tremendously to the knowledge of how important voting is.
So in short,
I want to add one more thing if I can.
Okay, go ahead,
it's
Phil.
A little bit provocative, but having gone to a lot of classes and young people, 16 and 17 even, this is really hard to get through. There's a lot of eye rolling that goes on when you talk about it in the abstract. Some communities are actually pushing to let 16 and 17-year-olds vote in local elections. Okay, back in Maryland, there's a couple of communities doing it. 27 countries allow 16-year-olds to vote, including the people that voted on Scottish independence a few years ago. Now, that's not in a national election, but I can make an argument that if you teach civics to 16 and 17-year-olds to really make it real, exponentially more so, is actually empower them to vote for city council and mayor races. Now, that's going to get a lot of controversy, but I think it is worth looking at, and you've seen communities around the country doing exactly that. It barely failed at the ballot, actually, in San Francisco just a couple of years ago.
In Charlotte this year, there's a big effort to get millennials engaged. But is that the same thing as politicians engaging with and putting forth policies that are favored by millennials? You can encourage millennials to come out and vote or come to these debates or ask questions at debates. But can you be a politician if all the voters are old? Can you be a politician who will actively engage a millennial? Because if they do so, they might be working against their own self-interest as a politician because those people aren't voting for them anyway.
Well, we have some millennials, vying hard to be on city council here in Charlotte.
That may change things.
That may change things.
On both ends of the equation. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NC Warm, presenting Clean Path 2025, a strategy to slow climate change, save money, and create jobs with local solar power and battery storage. ncwarm.org. And Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Jesse Colin Young, formerly of the Youngbloods. Jesse performs jazz, blues, and folk music November 12th at McGlowan Theater. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org. Well, coming up next in 20 minutes on Point, Tom Ashbrook will be joined by Democratic National Committee Chair Tom Perez and Our Revolution President Nina Turner to talk about the Donna Brazile bombshells. Did the DNC rig the Democratic primary for Hillary Clinton? And discussion about local and regional elections around the country as well. We'll have election night coverage tonight beginning at 7 with a live special hosted by Tom Bullock and the political consultants featured in his Candidate Me podcast. And he'll take your calls tonight at 7 on WFAE.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Brazil has a new homicide count for 2016, and it's the highest in the country's recorded history.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
State health department officials wouldn't say how much the expanded program will cost, but it will likely be a lot. Last year, the state spent $72.6 million.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the reasons behind low voter turnout here in Charlotte and around the country. Voter turnout for today's election for mayor, city council, school board, and school bonds is predicted to be about 17%. Pretty awful. Phil Kiesling is with us, director of the Center for Public Service at the Mark Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University in Portland, Oregon. Aaron Weinschenk is associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. And Dolores Johnson Hurt is president of the local League of Women Voters here in Charlotte and Mecklenburg. Aaron, you've done a lot of research on this, and I know that you're an expert on voter behavior. What is the impact of low voter turnout on the makeup of our governing bodies, our election? Elected office holders, our politics. What is the end result of all of this?
Yeah, well, I think that the discussion we've been having about age, shows you something about it. You know, if the pool of people who turn out to vote is not representative of the general population, you can expect there to be biases in representation. What the people who elected look like, what issues are being talked about. So the effects of low turnout are huge. And it is one of those kind of vicious cycles where if you say nothing's going to happen and that leads you not to participate, then, you know, you're going to get the same outcomes over and over again. So
you say that low turnout elections are dominated by whiter, more affluent, older voters, which a UC San Diego study says contributes to poorer outcomes for minorities and the uneven prioritization of public spending. So that would mean that not only is low voter turnout unhealthy for the political aspects of our democracy, but also the social aspects. And we talk about people voting against their own economic self-interest. This is a case where people don't vote, and the result is it's a vote against their own economic self-interest. How do you explain that? Why don't people understand that?
Yeah, I think it's... You really have to sort of slap people in the face with things in order to get them to realize that this stuff is important to them. You know, I ask my students, do you vote in local elections or do you know anything about the people who are representing you? Most of them, unless they're real political junkies, say they have no idea. And then I start describing different issues. I talk about homelessness. I talk about the poverty levels. I talk about the types of businesses that we're trying to bring to downtown. And they care a lot about those issues, but they really just don't connect the dots that the people serving in city government can do something about those things.
Recently, maybe it's always been this way, but it's certainly been this way in recent years, that everything's becoming more rancorous. We have these deep divides between people and politicians and the left and the right and the Republicans and the Democrats and the federal people and the local people. And everybody's wrong, and if you vote for the other guy, you're dooming us to a fate worse than... I can't even describe it. And Aaron, you said that you wonder if the negativity surrounding government, and that's part of the problem. Politicians running for office decry government. They say government bad. So if you're running for office and you think government is bad, I just question why you're running. But if you keep saying that, then people are going to believe it. And you've said that you wonder if the negativity surrounding government in general is now seeping into local government and polluting politics at all levels.
Yeah, I think that.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'll just use my own city as an example. Local politics here have gotten very contentious in the last couple of years or so, where there are big rifts between certain groups on the city council and leadership, sometimes over very small issues that, you know, get blown up or that kind of dominate news coverage. And so that kind of thing can really turn people off of politics if they think that national level politicians are just bickering or they're gridlocked. And then they see kind of conflicts like that happening at the local level, they might just sort of disconnect.
But the problems at the local level, whether they're rancorously political or not, are things like fixing potholes, picking up the trash, cleaning our water, making sure that sewage goes to the right places and is treated properly. What's political? What's rancorous about that?
Well, it shouldn't be rancorous, but, you know, we have also situations in the local level about police and community relations are local. The issues of whether you can afford housing or have to move out of the city. The issues of you know, just kind of quality of life, pollution, traffic, and the like. Those are very keenly felt. And I think what has happened is that, you know, 30 years ago we said, well, if it's contentious, at least that's good. We'll get a lot of people interested in it. Now it's contentious, and it kind of drives people away. Mm-hmm. And I think I'll go back to what was said earlier. It does serve certain purposes. Certain people prefer low turnout elections. I think that's one of the reasons that primary party elections suit certain factions within both the Republican and the Democratic Party, and their factions that continue to pull people apart. So get back to that kind of that self-fulfilling prophecy dynamic that we seem to be too often locked into. People do trust local government more than they do state and federal government by far. There's lots of polls about that. But I think the challenge is to make it interesting, and that's where you get down to community leaders in each individual community to try to highlight the issues that are forward-looking, future-orienting, but also have some pizzazz to it, quite honestly.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because Evan has emailed us a question about that, and I was going to ask a question earlier about this. He says, I don't believe state and local elections are covered in a sexy or media-friendly way. It's hard for people who are busy with their own lives to focus on complex political issues, and national media is an endless bucket of money for splashy graphics and charismatic pundits. So how do you make local elections that deal with trash pickup or who the mayor may be, even though the mayor has no power, but they are a figurehead and they are the face of the city? How do you make that sexy, interesting?
I don't know if you can make it sexy, but I do know that oftentimes things have to hit close to home before you become involved. A number of our local officials have run on one issue items. One was a city councilwoman who I think was assaulted in her neighborhood.
Right.
She rallied her neighborhood and she got a lot of attention and she was elected to city council. That issue hit close to home.
Right.
Another school board member fought for a school not to be closed, and her passion subsequently led to her being elected to the school board.
Our incumbent mayor is not on the ballot because of two major issues, one would think, HB2 and the aftermath of the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott. Both of these things rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. So why isn't voter turnout enormous? Because we have an opportunity for you to change the way politicians address those issues that you disagreed with when the current mayor obviously was taking a different tack.
Isn't that still the million-dollar question here that we are trying to find answers for? But, you know, here in Charlotte, we might be surprised because I think our elections commissioner, Michael Dickerson, has predicted up to maybe 20% or more voting for mayor this go around.
Well, we'll see. Tony, on Facebook.
I'd like to go back, though, to something I said earlier. I really do think that part of the problem is the traditional polling place as itself a voter suppression tool. We found that when we transform these local elections from you have to go to the polls to your ballot shows up in the mail, you sign it, we check the signatures to verify, we saw races go from single digits like 8 to 9% to 30 or 40%. We have some of the highest off-year election rates in the country. And I think we need to rethink how we connect voters with their ballot.
Okay,
Phil, I think it ought to be the obligation to get people. So that's another thing to put into the mix.
Phil Kiesling is talking to us from Portland, Oregon, where they are, I believe, you have voter turnout exceeding 50%. Because of your state's vote-at-home system, where they mail a ballot, you fill it out, you sign it, you send it in, you vote on your own time, in your own home, and it's done. How do you keep it honest?
Well, you keep it honest because everybody has to sign the ballot and the signatures then verified against the voter registration card. We've had 12 cases of fraud over 100 million ballots. Over the years.
Okay.
And people can return it in the mail, or they can take it to a drop site, a courthouse, a fire station, a library. Look, we've had no problems with fraud. Fraud is one of the big bogeymen of
But how do you know? How do you know your ballot is delivered by the mailman? Because we have had instances in with the Postal Service where big treasure troves of mail have been found in dumpsters, not voting mail, but just mail in general in dumpsters. So how do you know it's being delivered?
Well, A, it isn't a problem, and B, when you know there's election, there's at least community groups paying attention. You know, there's always some people paying a lot of attention around an election to keep an eye on that. If a voter doesn't have it, you simply call a county courthouse and ask for another ballot because, you know, you can have a replacement on it. We also have developed applications. You literally can find out where your ballot is in the return process. Has it been received? Has it been approved? Has it been counted? Notify you by text message. We live in a technological era that's a revolution in terms of the ability to keep track of things. And the other thing that happens when that ballot comes and you're at your home, you can now get on the internet and find out what the candidates are saying, what the local issues are, who's saying what, which community groups are supporting which candidates. So you have a much more information-rich environment than you used to have, you know, 20, 30 years ago, and you'd have to rely, let's say, on a voter's pamphlet or the newspaper. So we have the means, but by letting people vote at their kitchen table, often with family members, often with younger people, we talk about how to engage younger people. I used to vote with our kids sitting around the kitchen table in these races to kind of get them educated about it. So while it's a beloved tradition of traipsing to the polling place, regardless of whether the weather is wonderful or terrible, regardless of whether the traffic is light or a traffic jam or you got sick kids or have to work late, when you're no longer having to do that, but instead can do it on your terms, I think that's going to not only increase turnout, but increase the richness of the engagement around the voting experience.
Well, if it's so successful in Oregon, which it is, particularly in Portland, why haven't other states been racing to adopt a similar policy?
Same concerns you raised, you know, gee, isn't it kind of sketchy? Is it going to be fraudulent? Might there be problems with it? There's also, quite honestly, again, people that don't like higher turnout in certain kinds of races. I fought Democrats. I fought Republicans about it over the years. People get really worried about which side is going to advantage. And again, in a highly polarized society that we live in, that's tough. So if you do it for local elections, it can be a little easier, although you have partisan elections in Charlotte. Most cities don't. They have nonpartisan elections. But, the only three states, Oregon, Colorado, and Washington, now have adopted the system. It's not a panacea. And, again, right. Portland piggybacked its mayor's race on the presidential, and that helps probably even more.
So Logan on Twitter writes, "We don't know what he doesn't know what the solution is, but elections need to move the way of the world, which means online. Given what we know about Russian interference in our elections, right down to election precincts, is that ever going to happen now? Are we ever going to have online?"
I think we will. I mean, that's the way of the world, as you just said. I think that every person born in this country should be registered at birth. Okay. That's a new way of looking at things. You get that out of the way right away. And then we know that we will have to monitor electronic voting or voting online, or which I feel is the future. And I think that's the way we will probably get more people involved. They can do this from home.
So, Aaron, what would you say to Colleen from Weddington who writes, "I may opt out today. All options are unappealing."
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a pretty common perception that people have. And I would say you still, you know, you can write people in. That's certainly an option in a lot of places. But sometimes you have to make a choice, even when you don't think when you don't think the options are the greatest, right? Because otherwise, you're letting other people make decisions for you.
Thomas on Facebook writes, "In Australia, if you don't vote, you pay a fee. Voter turnout is significantly higher than it is here. But I have to ask: does getting more people to the polls end in better results? Do we want people voting just because they have to? People who have not paid attention to the issues or the candidates, do we want them pulling a lever?"
I don't think you'll ever see mandatory voting here in the United States. I think it offends so many traditions of both the left and the right.
Okay, but does getting more people involved in the process, does that end with better results? Or do you want people who are really invested in the process to be controlling the process?
Well, the League of Women Voters has been around almost 100 years now, and our position is that every citizen should vote. This is a democracy after all, and really take part in it and
participate. But that wasn't the Founding Fathers' point of view, so Phil, tell me what you think.
Yeah, I think you have accountability. When more people vote, you have more accountability.
Okay.
The premise of a democratic society, small d, is that we're all in this together, and whether you hate or love the result, at least you're part of the process that got you there. When people can step back and say, well, I don't have anything to do with it, I'm just kind of looking about it, you know, those darn politicians, you, in a sense, fray and corrode those bonds of mutual obligation and responsibility in a democratic small d society. And so we basically become an aristocracy or a gerontocracy in this particular case, given the generational differences that you have. And that, I think, over time, leads to the destruction of norms, a lack of civility, and more polarization and downward spiral. I think we've got a crisis going on in this country. This is a canary in the mine shaft about low voter turnout in local elections. We have it in other elections, too.
We haven't even touched yet on spending in these elections. And I know that, Aaron, you found out that there are steep increases in voter turnout when comparing contests that have hardly any spending to those that spend about $10 per citizen. But we don't have time to talk about that now. Aaron Weinschenk is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. Phil Kiesling, Director of the Center for Public Service at the Mark Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University. And Dolores Johnson-Hurt, President of the League of Women Voters in Charlotte-Mecklenburg.